brothers in the Dharma. So Sadaloka referred to that reference in Bhante's message, what is the Western Buddhist Order, or what is the Tri Ratna Buddhist Order, where he defines it as the community of my disciples and the disciples of my disciples and the disciples of my disciples and so on. And some people were a bit surprised when he defined the order thus. Some people felt a little bit uncomfortable with it. Most people were delighted to actually read this. It described exactly their experience. They felt themselves to be involved in an order in which Sangharakshita is the teacher, and they regarded themselves as learning from him and training with him and with his disciples. And certainly it reflected that statement, my own understanding, my own feeling, my own actual experience. I decided very early on in my involvement, over 30 years ago, before I was even ordained, that Sangharakshita was my teacher. I found my master. I found my teacher. And I regarded his senior disciples as my Kalyana Mitras very, very quickly. And when I was ordained, I definitely felt that I had formally become Sangharakshita's disciple. And I joined the community of his disciples. And I was practicing with them and working with them to establish the Dharma throughout the world. That's what I felt, what I've always felt, and which I've never actually doubted. So what I want to do in this talk is talk about what it's meant to me to be a disciple of Sangharakshita. Before that, though, I just want to just look at the term disciple. We can translate it back into a number of Pali and Sanskrit words. The Pali word, it can be translated back into is sekha, which means in want of training, one who still has to learn. And apparently that is applied to everybody up to arhatship. Only an arhat, an enlightened being, is asekha, without training. So if you say that you are not training, you're either an arhat or you're deluded. And of course, this idea that sekha means learning is really what the word disciple means in our own language. The root of disciple simply means to learn, one who is learning, although the connotations, of course, are spiritual and are religious. Another word that we could translate as disciple is sāvaka or śravaka in Sanskrit, which means hearer, listener, someone who is listening and hearing the Dharma from a teacher. We also have the Sanskrit word shishya, which means pupil, learner, disciple. And again, the word shishya is probably somewhere related to the idea of being in training. All these terms, the connotations of all these terms, is of learning from a higher source. You're not just getting information or a technique. You're entering into something which is actually involving spiritual transformation. And you're going to somebody you regard as a teacher, not just because they just know a technique, but because they stand on a higher level of consciousness from you. They have greater spiritual experience, and you respect them and revere them and take their words and their example as your teaching, as your training. You take it all, everything they say and do, very seriously. It all has great weight for you. And I very quickly felt this in relation to Sangharakshita. I felt it through meeting his own disciples. So I was very deeply impressed by their example when I first came along, by the way they lived, by their dedication, as well as by their teaching. That made a very deep impression, and as well as their devotion, their faith, their reverence for Sangharakshita. And then, of course, I began to read Sangharakshita's books, listen to the tape lectures. It all made a very deep impression immediately. And then I met him. And I was eventually ordained by him, and yes, he is my teacher. He still is my teacher, and I'm deeply honoured to be his disciple, and I'm deeply honoured that he should regard myself and others in the order as his disciples. So I'm going to tell you some of the things I've learned from Sangharakshita over the years. Remember, a disciple is a learner. So I'm going to tell you what I've received from Sangharakshita, in no particular order, really. That's just what immediately occurred to me as I was sitting thinking about this talk this afternoon. So first of all, love of the Dharma. Love of the Dharma. This is something I've learned or imbibed from Sangharakshita. After I was ordained, Sangharakshita sent me a postcard of a painting by René Magritte of a blue sky with three apples floating in this sky, in this space. A blue apple, a red apple, and a golden apple. And the name of the painting by Magritte was called First Love. First Love. And I looked at it and I thought, is there a message here? And then, of course, the colour of the apples were the colour of the three jewels. It was as if he was saying in this postcard, make your first love the three jewels. Make your first love the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. And in all of Bhante's lectures and writings and the various conversations I've had with him, I've so often, well, repeatedly, felt that he's communicated love of the Dharma, love of the spiritual life, enthusiasm for really living the life of the Dharma, the inspiration of living the Dharma, all these things. When I first heard his lectures, first of all on tape, they were just so alive with love of the Dharma. And when I started to read his poetry, especially his early poems, they're just alive with love and longing for the Dharma, longing for living the Dharma. And what a relief it was to find someone with that kind of love, who communicated that love with intensity, with passion. You remember those early lectures when I heard them, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. They were so rich, so vivid, and you know, you could hear the sort of the lectern being banged and the microphone vibrating. So much energy and intensity. And I wanted to be able to love like that myself when I heard that. I wanted to be able to express love of ideals, love of vision in that way, and live from that love. And it was such a relief, because the world, you know, that was often presented to me, people could be so cool, so clinical, so cynical, yes, so clinical, so clever. What a relief to meet someone who took seriously my love for the Dharma, my youthful enthusiasm for the spiritual life, who didn't try to undercut it and undermine it, but just who delighted in it. I remember when Bhante told me he was going to ordain me, he was looking at me with this real twinkle in his eye, and he told me, I've decided to ordain you. And I was really thrilled, you can imagine. And he was looking at me as I was making him a cup of tea and pouring the tea, and I was sort of shaking with excitement. And he said, young people have a lot to offer the Dharma, a lot to offer the order. You see, 19 was young in those days in the movement. The old boys were in their 30s in those days. Young people have a lot to offer the Dharma. He said, you know, you do not have to go through things to live the life of the Dharma. There were people who didn't take me seriously. You know, but the message was from some people, well, you can't be serious. You haven't lived. You haven't broken your heart yet. And, you know, you haven't been ground down by life. So how can you be serious? But he wouldn't have any of that. He just loved my enthusiasm and encouraged it. So often, that's you know, what he did with me in those early days. And this love is so crucial. This intense emotional involvement in the Dharma is so crucial. I mean, another great feature of Bhante is his emphasis on beauty. The beauty of enlightenment. The beauty of beauty. It's so important to engage our love and our emotion in what is beautiful in the Dharma. If we don't do that, we are going to go under. And another big part of this was, yes, at my ordination, this sense of taking my youthful inspiration, my youthful commitment very, very seriously. At my private ordination, it was as if he didn't use these words, but the whole flavour of it, this is real. This isn't a fantasy. This isn't a game. This is you. That's what seemed to be going on. And in fact, I was saying to somebody the other day, if all I'd ever had from Sangharakshita was my private and public ordination, that would be enough. I wouldn't need anything else, because it was all the kind of all aspects of my discipleship, whatever you want to call it, were focused in that particular event. Secondly, the second thing I've learned from Sangharakshita is clarity. Bhante is famous for his clarity, his clear, essential communication of the Dharma, his communication of the wealth of the Dharma. I feel he's opened up the wealth of the Buddhist tradition for me. In fact, more than that, the wealth of the best in all spiritual traditions. I've been in seminars with Bhante where the range of reference is extraordinary. Christian mysticism, Islamic mysticism, Hinduism, poetry, literature from all traditions. He's an incredible educator. He's my educator, my cultural educator. There's so much he's opened up in terms of literature, art, music, yes, and other spiritual traditions. And he's presented to me, at the heart of all this, a clear, coherent path of spiritual practice. He has given me my trainings, my shikshas. He's given me the 10 precepts, ethics. He's given me meditation practices and personal instruction in meditation. He's given me a system of meditative practices. He's given me a training in wisdom. He's communicated to me the eye of the Dharma. He's communicated to me an eye for the essentials. One of the great things about Sangharakshita, there's this breadth, but this tremendous eye for what is essential, the living spiritual principle of the Dharma. You know, it's everywhere in his writing, in his communication. It's especially present in chapter 1 of the survey. It's all there, the great depth and profundity of the essence of the Dharma. And what's incredible about it, what it's well worth reflecting on, what I've reflected, there is no way I could have worked this out for myself. You know, if I hadn't encountered Sangharakshita, I would have been bumbling and stumbling around with my enthusiasm, but with no clear, coherent path of spiritual practice. You know, and sometimes people, they can criticise Sangharakshita, but actually they can only criticise him because he's given the tools for them to criticise. That's what's really interesting sometimes. They wouldn't actually know the questions to ask, the points to make, without his teaching. So he's given me a clear path of practice, of training. He's given me clarity in other ways. He's stressed the importance of being clear. Clarity, of course, is the basis for action. Right view is the basis for right conduct. Confusion leads to bad action that can harm oneself and others. And the number of times I've been in seminars where there's this insistence on clarity, the number of times I've asked a question, and then you get the reply, there seems to be an assumption here. And the question is undone. So many times in seminars, he was teaching us how to think. It was like being with somebody like Socrates, just undoing your questions, undoing your assumptions, Just because you can put these thoughts together doesn't mean they actually have any meaning. Inquiring into meaning. Very, very challenging. I remember in a very early seminar when he asked us a question, why is this? I can't remember the actual point. And I said, well, is it because because we're attached. I didn't say, is it? I said, because we're attached, or because of attachment. He said, well, that's a good Buddhist answer. And it was as if to say, come on, think. Don't just come out with cant, with jargon. Think. So he's really tried, really worked on teaching me, teaching us, how to think, and especially to think and reflect clearly, dharmically, on everything. So clarity, he's given me clarity. Thirdly, he's given me community. In the Mahayana tradition of the Bodhisattva, which of course we often think of as being incredibly cosmic, actually, you also find texts which unpack that in a very practical way. The great Yogacara practitioner Asanga has written extensively on the Bodhisattva path. And one of the things he says is that a Bodhisattva gathers or creates a community by giving himself as a resource. And he does this in so many ways. He teaches that community. He supports the activity of that community so that it grows. He even provides or helps to provide livelihood, lodgings, all these things, so that people can come together, so that he can communicate the Dharma, so that more and more people can benefit. And Sangharakshita has given himself completely and fully to create our community. His life has been one of continual service to this community. He hasn't just given lectures and seminars. He hasn't just led retreats. He hasn't just ordained people. That would be enough. He has been involved in countless personal communications. So many interviews, which he continues to do. A vast correspondence. He's been extraordinarily open and honest over the years about his life in a way that I know of no other teacher actually doing. He's been deeply involved in people's lives in all kinds of ways. We don't know a fraction of this. In the very early days of the movement, he'd help out at jumble sales. He would be there behind the white elephant stall, the bric-a-brac, driving very hard bargains. I think some of the older members would say, Bhante, I think you're charging too much for that. He sold off some of his Tibetan treasures to support himself, to work for the Dharma. His life has been one of continual befriending and encouraging others to create community. And he's still giving, still sharing in this way. And what we have to be clear about with Sangharakshita, he is not a gregarious person. He isn't a sort of speedy, glad hander or anything like that. He's created community because he has a deep insight into what we might call the oneness of humanity. In a famous passage, he says that he believes that humanity is one. Any human being can understand any other human being. Any human being can communicate with any other human being, and he would even die for that belief. I've been looking through some old postcards and letters today, a few that I've managed to hold on to on my travels from Bhante. And in these postcards and letters, I mean, there's also just the sheer fact of him remembering me wherever, from different parts of the world. On his travels, me among many other people remembering me. I wasn't the only person he was remembering, but there are so many references to other people, particularly other order members in difficulty, asking me if I'd been in touch with them, asking them if they were all right, and asking me to let him know if I'd had any contact with them. There's this deep concern for the welfare, for the worldly spiritual welfare of all order members, mitras and friends. Some weeks ago, in fact, I had a long phone call with him about a particular matter, that I'm involved with, a particular area of Sangha life. And what came over was this deep concern for the spiritual welfare and the spiritual integrity of our Sangha, of our spiritual community. Now this is, remember, a man, was it 84, is it, 85? Still concerned on this level. So fourthly, compassion. Sangharakshita is not, as he said himself, a touchy-feely person. He's not given to sentimentality. But I can assure you, he is a deeply tender-hearted and compassionate man. Along with that incredible clarity, even quite fierce, forthright clarity, there is a deep compassion for others. I remember some experiences of this. One in India, many years ago, when we were first there, and Sangharakshita had come out there to do ordinations, to give lectures to thousands of people, and I was his sort of attendant, which I really enjoyed. I loved being his attendant. One of the happiest periods of my life, gathering up the garlands that were given, making sure his sandals were on his feet, taking him through the crowds, making his tea, washing his robes, typing his letters. It was an incredibly happy time for me. I think I'd much prefer to operate like that than in any other way, actually. I felt the most appropriate way to be in relationship to him. And as we were going through the crowd, I thought people were bothering him. All these Indian Buddhists, very poor, of course, from a background which was known as untouchable. And I remember trying to push people away. And he just gently but firmly put his hand on my shoulder, said, "You mustn't do that. This is very important for them." And there was this real tenderness, this real compassion, this real understanding of the position that these people wanted to touch him. They wanted to make connection. For him, he was an important, how can we say, a spiritual teacher for them, that they wanted that direct connection with. And it was that tender, compassionate response. And he didn't sort of rebuke me. He just said he was compassionate to me too, because I was ignorant. I didn't understand. I've had the experience of talking to him about an order member, or mitras that I'm fed up with. And, perhaps other people are. And it's like encountering a Teflon pan. It's absolutely non-stick. I've never, ever found him allowing me to indulge my negative, harsh speech about somebody. He'd just give me this sort of, he'd sort of look away and just talk about their qualities. And I'd try again, and I'd just bounce off, and it was quite clear. The message was, no, you understand. You must understand these people. You have the problem. And then more personally, some years ago I was in a bit of a crisis, a crisis of confidence about teaching the Dharma, practicing the Dharma, and I went to see him. And, of course, you have to remember that Sangharakshita's eyesight is very poor. I told him my difficulties. And what I encountered was this incredible quality of attention. Incredible presence. Somebody really hearing, really listening to my crisis. With real concern and understanding. And saying exactly the right things that could really help me. Not solving it, but giving me things to really think about without sentiment. And then again, I've experienced Sangharakshita's forgiveness. There was a time in my life where I'd behaved very badly as an order member, even to the extent of having very big arguments with Sangharakshita over a period of time. I mean, on one occasion, I experienced the wrathful Sangharakshita when I was being particularly obtuse, and on came the burners, and that was right, okay, but the burners didn't stop for a while. He really wanted to make his point. But sometime after this, I really wanted to apologise to him and just tell him that I was deeply sorry that I'd troubled him. And a peculiar atmosphere came over our meeting. He looked at me with this very strange expression. I think it was a compassionate expression. And he just said, "You haven't given me any trouble at all." Now, it could think, well, you could interpret that, well, you're a bit too small to give me any trouble. But it wasn't like that. It was as if he was saying, "That's finished. That's not you now." And this mood, this atmosphere of being completely forgiven. Incredible, incredible experience for me. And that brings me to a quality of Sangharakshita that I've received, which I just can only call otherness. A touch of the inconceivable. Sangharakshita in a talk says that part of a bodhisattva's skillful means is a touch of the inconceivable. I felt that at my private ordination, particularly associated with the transmission of the mantra. And I feel it in relation to my chosen bodhisattva. But there's so many other glimpses of that dimension, this sort of sense that he's spoken of, that he didn't start the order, that something started it through him. He wasn't the best person to actually start an order in the first place. And that amazing phrase that sometimes he says, "I'm dimly aware of a vast overshadowing consciousness that has through me started the order." There's something about him, as he says, that you cannot pin down, and there's something about the order that you cannot pin down. I remember recently in study seminars with him, we'd get on to talking about nirvana. And he said, perhaps we should just pause here and contemplate this meaning of nirvana's and world, or this vimukti or something like this, the particular turns of phrase. And of course, we quickly rushed in to ask questions. And he said, perhaps it's best not to say anything. And it's as if what he was trying to say to us, well, let's just sit here for a while and just contemplate this teaching of the Buddha. I've always felt that otherness, that mystery around Sangharakshita. It's something incredibly fascinating that's drawn me and continues to draw me and propel me more and more deeply into the Dharma. I don't know where it will lead. And finally, the sixth thing I've learned from Sangharakshita, and this is the recurring theme actually, is responsibility. I can remember Sangharakshita, I can actually hear him say it, a line from the Dhammapada: "By you must the zealous effort be made. The Buddhas only point the way." Early on at my Kalyanamitra ceremony, I remember Sangharakshita, well, really being quite fierce, saying, "This is your first real action in the spiritual life. Your first act. Everything's been thought, everything's been felt, everything's been said. Now you are acting. Now you're really doing something." And like I said, at my ordination, it was as if he's saying, this isn't a game. This is the real thing. In India, I remember being so overcome by the devotional atmosphere, saying to Sangharakshita, as I was saying goodnight to him, "Oh, Bhante, I don't know what I will do when you die." And quick as a flash, he replied, "Well, that's assuming I'll die first." And then later on saying, "Young single men," and he's talking to me, "need to grow up. They need to take responsibility for something. You need to take responsibility for something. Otherwise, you won't grow up. You might get married and have a family. You might be a hermit. You might go and start a centre. But you must do something." And sometimes, you know, looking back, anything that I said to him, which would be letting myself off the hook, he would always counter it, sometimes very playfully, with throwing me back onto myself. On one occasion, he said to me, you know, I was in a particular kind of conflict going on, being bounced back and forth between two people and not really coming to my own conclusions. He said to me, "You're being ground between two stones." And repeatedly, there has been his acknowledgement of my ability to decide what to do with my life and how to live. I found a letter that he wrote to me in 1988, where I was wondering about a particular decision to make. And this is what he said. "I have communicated my thoughts on the subject quite clearly. Please be assured that I have great faith in your sincerity and integrity, and that I am sure that in this, as in other matters, any decision you take will be taken in the best interests of all concerned." And I can remember when I read that, being incredibly moved at his, you know, real, you know, showing confidence in me, but also really quite shocked and shaken that it's down to me. So these are just a handful of leaves from a forest of leaves that have been given to me by Sangharakshita. "I describe myself as a disciple of Sangharakshita at the beginning of this talk. I'm honoured to be a disciple. I'm proud to be a disciple. But the real question is, of what quality? Of what quality disciple am I? Am I good enough to be a disciple of Sangharakshita? It's not so much whether you are or we are a disciple of Sangharakshita. It's, are you, am I worthy of being a disciple of Sangharakshita? More than that, Sangharakshita said, preceptors need to regard the people they ordain as disciples. He's put this quite strongly recently. He said, if preceptors, new preceptors, don't regard people they've ordained as disciples, the order will die out. So the question for me is, am I a good enough disciple to transmit, to communicate what I've learned, the great treasures I've learned from Sangharakshita, to communicate it to others? Only time will tell. We have a great teacher who's now in his old age. Will we live up to what he's taught, to what he's demonstrated? That is the real issue.